one must, you know, inform, wasn't that situation for me, to inform parents. And the other one must be free of debt, because of course there can be a running away from debt, and that could leave a lot of pain and distress for others. So I wrote to my parents, and I said, I've decided to take ordination, decided to become a Buddhist monk. I still remember, my mother wrote back, because this is long, there wasn't even any telephones around, hardly around, let alone emails, etc. So everything went by letter. Mother wrote back, the first thought that arose in my mind, in her mind, was, what have I done wrong? First thought, what have I done wrong? First thought. And then she's ringing up the head of the theological seminary in Rome, Monsignor Curtin, who's a good family friend of ours, and said to him, oh Monsignor, she wrote all this letter, oh Monsignor, Monsignor, something terrible has happened. He said, Christopher's become a Buddhist monk. She said, is he excommunicated? See, you know what excommunicated is? Chucked out of the Catholic Church, you know. The last person to be chucked out of the Catholic Church was Castro. So she thought I was the next. And she said, no. And he said, no, thank goodness. No. He's following his heart, etc., etc. So sometimes something happens with a loved one who is around us, and the way that we interpret it is we take responsibility. What have I done wrong? And that's the attachment to the result. And we forget the goodness of the intention. We forget, or in the case of my good mother, I regard it not as a statement of what she has done wrong, but I regarded as an expression of good parenting. The fact that she gave, that I had the trust and the confidence to hitchhike, travel across to the east in my early 20s, I had the trust and the confidence to live very, very simply on the road, trust and confidence to go to the monastery, shave my head, live in an environment where there's no Westerners in the forest there, etc., 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 etc. It was a compliment to her, not a rejection, and to my father. So sometimes, let's say, with responsibility, we have to see, what am I doing with it? Am I putting too much either on results, and then when circumstances change, does that responsibility kind of fall back on me, usually self-blame? Usually the signal of exaggerated sense of responsibility there. The other in this movement, and once again it does come back to our ability to, as I said earlier, settle into the here and now, the sense of calm abiding, as the Buddhists will say, sensing the inner peace that goes with it, so letting things of time rest. Letting things of time, what's going on in the present, what's going on in the past, what am I going to do, letting it rest. And hopefully there are plenty of moments in the day, anywhere, plenty of opportunities to let it rest. And one of the much loved teachers, Thai, Thich Nhat Hanh, he has the he calls it the mindfulness bell. And one can be in, say, one of his centers, can be at his resource in France, there. And just at some time, someone would just ring the bell, and we just stop, just to rest in the moment, just to be. He'll say, there's a small tip, when the phone rings, before rushing to answer, just let it ring three times. Just rest in the moment. And we forget, it's not only as we rest in the moment, we can let what around us rest as well. But also, in that resting in the moment, there is the potential to access something deeper than time, deeper than the things of time, the constructions of time. And that matters a great deal. One of the issues in dualistic mind, particularly for those engaged in karma yoga service, work for others, and all the ways that we can do it, is it in the movement of our mind we can extend ourselves in such a way that there's neglect for one's own being? Is it possible, and this is a great challenge for us, to regard oneself not as myself? Is it possible to have an awareness in life that another and what we call myself is treated in the same light? Normal mind, everyday, even good normal mind says, if I'm doing for others, this is good. But if I'm doing for myself, well, it's a bit selfish. This thought is ego. It's ego thinking. Is it possible to have an awareness of life in which so-called, one's own life, so-called, is equally placed in front of the consciousness as another's? The life of the group here together this evening, and in this case the life of Christopher, that is placed equally, that the awareness says, at times support for the group, at times support and connection, responsibility for the individual, at times care, support, responsibility for that which is called Christopher. That one's awareness is steady enough in life that the support for the being, this way it's called Christopher, the support for another or others, one's awareness expands to include both. When it does, and it's clear, there's no feeling of selfishness, no feeling of, oh, this care for this being is neglecting others. And our awareness practice, our abiding with consciousness and clear consciousness, is such that care for this being, which we call I, which we call me, which we call myself, and care for what we call another person or another life or another number of people, both are seen with the same light. Both are held in the same awareness. And wisdom says, at times, more time for this being. Which, more time for this being, which matters. And one really wants to embrace both. This is called non-dual realization. A non-dual understanding. Because a person who is caught in the dual will either keep going out and neglect oneself, and then one feels tired, exhausted, stressed and burnt out. There's a huge number of people who are exhausted serving other people. Why? Because they forgot to serve the one who serves. They forgot to serve the one who's doing the service. And there's a whole tradition, a very important one, And to some degree retreats are an expression of it, where we go out, we find ways to serve others, then we return, as it were, back to ourselves. We gain renewal and we go out and serve. We take time out, we get renewal and we go out and serve. And that dynamic, and getting that right with our lives, shows that we are treating others with great respect and we are treating ourselves with great respect. We are treating ourselves with great respect to treat others with great respect. And this non-dual understanding means this balance and this embrace. It gets problematic through exaggerated responsibility, because it either goes too much out there or it comes too much back on us. All right, enough. Any responses? Any questions? Anything at all that you might like to touch upon with what was said? And I'll try to answer, or I'll ask a question or two in return, and you just let it flow. Yes, anyone?
The word for it, but I found that you made it so clear.
Oh, thank you. Good. It's a privilege to serve others. And also, one of the nice things about teaching, as many of us know as well, that in the very act of it, and the Buddha commented on this as well, the expression of the teaching is also teaching the one who's talking. It's going all the directions. So much of what is said, just as most of it with these things, it's unlikely with Dharma teachings that you or I will hear anything that's new. Most of it we know, but we forget. But the actual joy and the delight of the teaching is not only is it going, you know, outwardly, but also, and equally important, this person called Christopher is getting the reminders as well. You know, it goes in both directions. Thank goodness. It's the opportunity for the teacher to be a lifelong student. Yes, anyone, please. Yes, please, yes.
I don't quite understand how the first part that you were talking about resting in the moment,
yes,
was connected to the part about the responsibility and what setting is new.
Oh, yeah, right. That's a good point. In the pure resting in the moment, just like this, I'm going to take, you know, right this. Here now, not the theory here, just in the resting in the moment. In that resting of the moment, I'm not concerned in just this resting with, as it were, what or who's out there. It's just the seeing, as I said. And here either. I'm just quietly resting in the moment. And that resting in the moment gives a sense of inner peace and no activity, nothing being constructed, such as talking about, referring to, just really resting in the moment. Allowing plenty of time and moments for the opportunity for that during the day will allow out of one's being a way of responding which doesn't feel like I'm going from resting in the moment to responsibility for. I don't feel I'm coming out of the being. I don't feel I've oh, I've got to look after, I've got to give attention to, and I kind of feel the being, the energy and everything kind of moving up, and there. So the ability to rest in the moment, even in difficult situations. I was speaking to a nurse here who works in the emergency, and sometimes, you know, in critical situations, emergency, a person's heartbeat stops. The degree of intensity, you know, is very, very high. It's critical. It's a life and death situation. One's got to act quickly, decisively, etc. Even in such situations which have a critical edge to it, it doesn't mean to say that it has to be stressful and pressurized and intensification of all responsibility for. So if we can just practice in the less dramatic situations of our day-to-day life, where we get a feeling sense of being pulled out towards, and just resting in, and therefore coming from a place of resting in and acting in connection with. And so the sense of connection begins to be felt more, rather than this I have to be responsible for, rather than the results really matter. Because most things, the results are not really in our hands. They're not, either through presence or through absence. And we need the reminders, of this, because if we remember this, there would be no stress in life. There would be no stress. Someone said to, I don't want to boast or anything, it'd be silly. But 2 weeks ago, I was in Saranath. Then there was a 15-17 hour train journey to Delhi. Then overnight, then a 9 hour flight to London, then another 5 or 6 hours down to Totnes, then a few days there, 360 emails to read through, look through, then up to London to, and then down to Brighton for a yatra, then a public meeting, then back to Totnes, then train to Heathrow, then arriving last Wednesday morning in Israel, talk at lunchtime, public meeting in the evening, till in the following morning, London tomorrow, Hamburg, Dusseldorf, somewhere anywhere in Germany on Thursday morning, etc. People say to me, Christopher, I could not live like that. And my response was, it's okay, it's easy, as long as I can rest in the moment. There's no problem as long as one can rest in the moment. If one can't rest in the moment, even when I'm just talking about it, I start to feel tired.
You're tired.
And you're tired, yes, right, exactly, Dada, right, exactly. So long as one rests in the moment, then the things of time, going from A to B to C to D, all right, long we can rest in the moment. And that stops the situation from being exhausting and pressurized and stressful, etc. And this is the beauty of it. But it's a beauty which can go so deep, it's liberating. That's the point, it's actually liberating. It's freeing. Freeing from movements of time, things of time. And all those deep spiritual teachings are teachings of liberation. They're teachings of freedom from feeling caught up in time. And that can be happening even as we just have an evening together and talk and look into these things together. And be free while the exchange is taking place. Not feeling, God, Dad, when this is over, then I can be free to go and do something else. No. Right in the activity, we can feel our freedom. Yes, anyone, please.
Yeah, question, and I just
probably not. Remind me. Commitment. All right. Okay. Oh yes. Yeah. Right, right, right. Slightly, relationship with responsibility, with commitment, but with commitment. Quite often, we say, it could be in a personal relationship, because the obvious ones that come to mind for us. It could be with relationship to a particular task and undertaking, that we start, we make a commitment to do something, etc. And I think we have to know ourselves rather well with regard to commitment. We really have to know ourselves rather well. And what I mean by that is that sometimes with commitment, it's an energy, a focus, and a decision which we make in the present moment into the future. And what can happen is we may not have the sustainability of the focused attention, we may not have the energy for, and it may be that the outcome is something else happens around us which affects the commitment. So sometimes the commitment is affected by what we are feeling inside. The commitment is affected by what's happening outside. And therefore, commitment, I know it sounds like bad news at the moment, but commitment by its very character is vulnerable. You have a commitment to something, but the other person who was sharing the commitment drops their commitment, the obvious one. We have a commitment to something, but the whole interest just drops out of it. So it doesn't matter too much how strong the commitment is at the very beginning. It doesn't matter how determined we are. There's no assurance that it's sustainable. And this is the vulnerability with commitments. And I think it's even harder with the busy lives we have, with the priority of self in the culture, the priority of me, 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 I, and all the commitments we think we should have, to actually maintain commitment. And sometimes, it happens in our generation, in the current, but certainly in previous generations, if we take a relationship, sometimes because of religious reasons, sometimes because of children, two people stay in the relationship, they have a commitment, they've made vows, etc. And it's just abiding in the hell realms. And conflict, arguing, yelling, shouting, life is miserable, they can't stand each other, they've moved, as we were hearing, I think yesterday, day before, moved to separate bedrooms, whatever it might be. And most people say, look, it's time for a change, time to start a new life. But one's stuck with the commitment, the vow, and it's very hard to change. I know people in religious life, in Buddhist world, who have made lifelong vows, strong lifelong vows, lay people. And then Buddhism is riddled with vows and rules and commitments and these. And then perhaps the vow is every day to do some kind of puja, some kind of devotional action. Every day to do so many mantras, you know, these kind of things. And then find that having done it for a period of time, the heart's no longer in it. But they've made a commitment. They made a vow to their guru. In the Tibetan tradition, this is common. Then they feel they can't get out of it. Then they feel guilty. Because they want to stop, they can't, etc., etc. And I just say, look, you either have to go and tell the guru, your teacher, that you've changed your mind and be open and honest and clear about it, or you have to be honest with yourself and say, look, I have changed, and to have the inner freedom to make the change. So just think, we need to be rather aware of the kind of vulnerable side that goes with commitment. One thing. Sometimes when we hear this, the thought then swings to the other extreme, and one says, well, if I don't have commitment, then I might as well have a really permissive lifestyle, get into bed with who I want any night of the week, or do what I feel like to do. There's no point in having commitments, because commitments don't last. I met with I was at somebody's home, and the woman, she was in her, lovely woman, in her, I think probably early 60s, and she said to me, oh, she's done some retreats with me, and she said to me, oh, Christopher, I'd like you to meet da-da-da, and then she said, this is, where else but California, she said, this is my ninth husband. Ninth husband. And as the evening wore on, she came up and she whispered to me, and she said, Christopher, I just want to tell you something. I'm thinking of getting a divorce. So some will interpret this and will say, well, it's clear that, you know, that this has been, she's not very good with commitment, some will say, etc. Or some will say, well, it's, you know, she's had so many failed marriages. But it depends on the attitude. She could say, I've been married 8 times before, and each of my marriages have been a great success, and now I'm trying a new one. Why not? So I think with commitment there, I think relationships, which is one of the areas of commitment, is the if there's a strength of contact and connection and love and support in the moment, and the commitment is close to the moment, I think it has much more chance of staying steady. That we keep commitment as close to the here and now as we can. And if we can do that, and that means that commitment is an activity of expression of love, and that will ensure continuity more than anything else. I don't see the point in just taking a vow and saying I'm committed, and the actuality is there's such neglect of the relationship, neglect of love, neglect of support, and the person saying is, I'm committed to you, but just too bad, I like to be out 7 nights a week with my friends. So commitment is the love. It is the activity. It is, and that is the support. And when that's there, the commitment will stay. And it's quite often the neglect of love lets commitment collapse. And I think it's very important we understand this relationship, that love comes first. If the love is there, it will sustain itself. And I think that to me is deeper and more important. Sometimes, just staying with relationship a little bit more for a moment, sometimes some people, lots of people that I meet, are rather afraid of commitment. They just hear the word commitment, oh no, and the image that comes to mind is being a canary in a cage. You know, oh God, commitment means being trapped, commitment is being stuck with, etc. And the other person wants commitment, so one is going, ah! And the other is saying, I need stronger commitment from you. And the stronger that one wants commitment, the other starts edging back, and it becomes a waltz, and one's dancing backwards. In it, what's the word? That dancing couple, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, right? And as someone said to me in the United States, that what did Ginger Rogers? What does she matter? I mean, all that she did was everything that Fred Astaire did, but she did it backwards. So sometimes there's this. It's true. So sometimes, if we listen to somebody, and this in the area of commitment, and the other person has some unease about commitment into the future, I don't think it's wise nor skillful for us to put pressure on that person to be committed, because it can bring a fear, it can bring a resistance to the future. Love is the connecting element, not saying I need more commitment from you. It's actually the love which does it. Similarly, in spiritual life and in Dharma practice, some people have a commitment to daily sitting. I met with one person a year or two ago. She told me that she had done an hour sitting every morning and every evening since the 1980s, and she said, I find it hard to remember when I didn't do it. Some people have this quite dedicated commitment there. But what can happen for some people with the love and the commitment, that spiritual life then becomes defined by the form called sitting form, which is the common one, the form called yoga, the form called going to a satsang, or form for men and women gathering together for a retreat or a program or workshop, etc., etc. And so there can be a commitment there, but sometimes for all of us, the length of time of the commitment, whether it's a few weeks, few months, years, or whatever, it can change. And sometimes, naturally, with our life and changing human beings, much of what we have connection with has a shelf life to it. It's a bit like strawberries. They don't stay on the shelf forever. They start to whatever. So again, it's important that we have a broad vision of what spirituality is, yet recognizing being in the moment always of value, recognizing this interaction between each other always of value, looking at areas of responsibility always has value to it, looking at commitment, what's a valuable commitment, what's a relationship to commitment. Am I putting on myself pressure to be committed? Am I putting pressure on somebody else to be committed? Etc. And if you like keep exploring this and taking an interest in all of this, then more wisdom and understanding comes for us. And that's the best. You're going to ask something, Dana?
Yeah, it was what, about what you said before about the resting in the moment.
Yes.
It's great what you say, but it's very I don't feel it's still practical. I mean,
no.
How to do it right.
Yes.
Now. Even when I was listening to you,
yes,
how you describe the kids to be in the moment,
yes,
at the same time my mind was thinking, but I'm not like this, it doesn't happen to me.
No.
So I'm not in the moment because I'm comparing and blaming and thinking.
Sure. Yeah. Anyway, at a certain level of awareness, all the thoughts that you just had are, or were, coming out of the moment. In a way, everything belongs to the moment. So even if I'm thinking a lot about yesterday or tomorrow, or about what I might say in the present, etc., everything's coming out of the moment. Actually, we can't get out of it. In a way, this is it. And we might say to ourselves, well, I never seem to be in the moment. Actually, we've never known life out of it. There ain't no chance. So, somehow or other, for us, like with some other things of life, the word how is hopeless. Because how says sometimes, what's the method? Is there a technique? How do I do it? And it's like we're trying in a way, because we want to, but we're trying in a way to bring the mind to get in the moment. And it's not a how-to, it's like with yoga. There's a little instruction, but the essential thing is the relaxing into. And it's in a way, relaxing into. So initially, it might mean quite clear reminders. And sometimes, if we're going to let ourselves use a little method and technique, one might say, it's a good country for this, I have to say, one might say, every time I hear a mobile phone ring, this is a reminder to relax into the moment. Now you get plenty of times every day now. So sometimes we might just take a small signal like that, yeah? And allow it. And that just serves as a small reminder. So sometimes a little methodology, or like the telephone ring or the gong and the bell, etc. It might be situations where you know quite often you kind of feel out of the moment. Doing too much. Running to past or present, so to speak. And then you may remind yourself, when I start to think about something, let this thinking about be the reminder to be in the moment. Let this be the reminder. So that we're not looking to always be in the moment, in a deeper sense, because very unlikely. But the criteria, the body of the teaching said, to be, so to speak, out of the moment, in which I give some attention to past, present or future, it's completely fine insofar as one isn't suffering over what one is thinking about. So the general sense is, with our day, abiding in the moment, when I have to think about, plan, organize, reflect on, arrange, etc., do, it's in harmony with the moment when it's not a problem. When it's not a problem, no problem. So I have the freedom to attend to what was, to what is, or what will be. It might require some time, care and attention. It might feel like I'm not right in the moment because I'm having to do this, but it's not a problem. And when it's not a problem, one can relax into the moment. And there's lots of opportunities, because every single moment of life is the opportunity for it. And mostly I do think it's a feeling inside the body. So, right now, what's the feeling?
Much better.
Much better. Are you saying this to be very kind to me, or are you...
Eh?
Next tense. All right. And it's that. Even sometimes it's a little discomfort with the body or whatever. But the appreciation of less tense, relaxing into, and to feel the presence, and so well and deep can it go, we can relax so well and calmly, we feel we're relaxed into something which is, in a way, eternal. We can feel our beings relaxing into something which was the same yesterday, the same today, and the same tomorrow. The same if we're awake or if we're asleep. It's the same if we're alive or if we're dead. It can be a sense of relaxing into something which is always available. And the moment is a key, it's a kind of reminder. So there's deep relaxation, and sometimes to relax into things which not life nor death can take away. And that's the best. Yes, anyone? Yes.
About responsibility.
Yes, please, do. Yes, that's right. Intentions with actions.
Mm-hmm. Of course, many times people do inflict suffering on others with what seems like the best of intentions.
Yes.
So, what then? I mean, I've heard you, for example, mention many times the actions of politicians.
Yes.
Letting them off responsibility to these actions.
No. Right. In this movement of life, which for human beings in our relative world is very much an engagement and a relationship with intentions, actions and results. If you and I think of all the things that we involved within our life, all the things that we talk about, all the things that we hear and all the things that we're involved in, etc., etc., we kind of boil it all down. What does it all come down to? It comes down to a relationship of intentions, actions and results. And we can see that personally and socially and religiously and politically. So, in some situations, of course, we refer in peace movement, of course, and others, human rights, etc., etc. We will refer to and speak about accountability. We will question, and it's a very important question of life, what are the intentions there? And a lot of speculation is taking place currently with intentions. It's important to look at our own intentions, and it's important to question other intentions. And if we see that the intentions keep leading to suffering, and in some cases intentionally leading to suffering, there's nothing ambiguous about it, it's intentionally leading to suffering. Just in my room here, I was just watching the news on BBC World, etc., etc. So it's reported that the Americans have a 21,000 pound in weight bomb. They're calling it the mother of bombs. And with the threat, of course, that they will drop it, or more than one, somewhere in Iraq. There. It's a weapon of mass destruction, no question, as all the other bombs are as well. And so he said, here's the intention, here's the possible action, and here's the possible consequences, the results. And it's up to us, whose commitment is to stop suffering. Whose commitment is to resolve suffering wherever it may manifest and whatever expressions it may take. To keep using the power of our awareness, the power of our intentions, the power of our concern, of our love, in fact, to question this sequence: intention, action, and result. So that there is a relationship between the action and the result. And in the tradition of deep spirituality, the result and the action must have a relationship. That the action must in some way or other in life, meaningful action, must reflect something of the result. In other words, put it simply, we do good to generate good. We don't cause suffering in the name of that it would be better later. We actually start right from the here and now and work effectively and diligently to ensure that intention, action and result is noble all the way through. And when it isn't, we question. When it isn't, we express doubt. When it isn't, we protest. When it isn't, we say there has to be accountability. And that's part of human responsibility. Not easy. Not easy. Yes, anyone, please. Yes, hi.
Also about intention and the result.
Yes.
I have a thought that I think this is causing a lot of suffering to a lot of people in the world.
Yeah.
And it's really bothering me now, not in a personal level, but I try not to do anything now. It's when I went, and nobody is willing to do anything together.
No.
Everybody's afraid that she will hurt us and it's our livelihood. And I decided that when I'm going to leave, and it will be in the end of the year, I have to do something for the other people that are going to stay. But then there is the question of causing suffering to her, because even though maybe I will do something to the other people, I think that she will suffer a lot, because if I do something to hurt her. So I don't know if it's a good thing to do, maybe to help the other people, because I think her action is really with bad intention. I don't know why she's doing it, but she's causing a lot of suffering for a lot of people. So how do you decide when your intention is good and why someone has to suffer and the other not? I don't know how to do that.
She has a position of authority, and you say she's causing suffering. Can I ask? Can speak quite generally. What shows that for you? What demonstrates? What reveals her actions, or what she says, or what she does, or what she writes is causing suffering? What would be examples of it?
She's yelling, sometimes she's threatening people, oh, you want to, don't want to do it, don't come to work, and you know, this kind of thing, and she's doing something else and she says you didn't say that. And people are in a position that we don't have, most of the people it's the only job. And they can't just leave and go to any other position, it's really difficult to find.
No.
So everybody just doesn't say anything, but all the time threatening. If you don't do it, okay, so just turn out to work. So and she's trying to say, she's saying something to one employee about other employees.
Mm.
Oh, she said about you, she came to me and said, and
yeah.
So
You see all this, the finding of fault, the blame, the threats, you know, the gossip, etc. What's your sense of what's all that about? What's your sense of what might be underneath all of that? But why is she acting so aggressively and negatively to her staff. But what do you think's underneath it?
She's very young.
She's very young. So you, are you saying that youth and all this is a relationship?
No.
No.
Maybe, but she's 23 and nothing. All of us are older, like 26, 27, and all of us have more experience from her in the field, but not in this organization. And we came from all kinds of places, and I feel that she's really threatened, and she has a sense of, I have to show them who I am, because
right.
I'm young,
and, all right.
And I think this is
kind the of feeling is she's insecure.
Really
insecure. Alright. So, what would you like to say to her? Before the end of the year, it's a long way away. I'm talking about tomorrow.
Maybe to go to send a letter or something.
It seems rather safe.
She's, I cried because of her a lot of time because
I really feel I have to tell you. She reads the first line.
No, not to her.
Not to her. Above her. Oh, naughty. More gossip. More telling tales. What would you like to say to her? No, 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 before you said I can't say, put it aside. What would you like to say? What do you think you would be pleased to hear? This is an area of awareness and responsibility. Can't take responsibility for her, but responsibility. What would you like to hear?
Just what? Understand why she's doing it. It's a lovely place and all the people are really nice, all the people that I work with, and she's the only one that causes the workplace to be really unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand why she's... I understand, I think she's really insecure. I think that she all the time has to prove that she's right. In control and she knows what she's doing and everyone else is not so smart and like her.
Right. But so you I don't think you will get very far if you ask her, why are you like this, why are you doing it? Because I doubt if she knows. So try again.
What to say?
If you say, wait, why are you like this? And she'll throw out 1,001 reasons, and you'll know it's all denial. So you're not going to say, well, I'm doing it because actually I'm very insecure, I'm only 23 years of age. And
people like that.
Well, it's a good chance to explore it. the responses. There's never guarantee. We've talked already about can't expect results. The first thought that comes in the mind, of course, one can't understand why you do it. But if you don't understand, what chance has she got when it's all so close to her? No chance. So, to repeat, because this happens, you know, frequently. What would be another way of approaching her? Completely different from the one that you just said. I'm not looking for a specific answer. I just want to listen to one that sounds like there's a little hope. That one's got, there's no hope in that. I don't think that...
My tactic is just to be really nice to her and this is my tactic now. Maybe if I be really nice and be maybe compassionate to her, it will change. I don't know. This is my tactic.
She might take it as a sign of weakness, submissiveness, and you're just trying to get on her nice side, and she'll give you a rough time because she thinks you're meek and a coward. Tell me another way.
I really don't know. This is something that just really bothered me for the last month, and I don't know how to approach. It makes me suffer with
you. I can hear. Yeah, yeah, it does. And as you said, the other staff also. So it's not just the individual.
I really don't know. Maybe someone can.
If I had a suitcase, so she could fly for a week.
Hey, what? Hey?
If I had the money, I would fly myself.
Okay.
Once I told her, and she said, "Oh, I really offended myself, and I was hurt from what you said, because sometimes we had a struggle," and then I said, "I don't understand why are you doing that?" And she said, afterwards I came to talk to her, and she was really like, I really was offended also by you, and so I didn't work. I told her what. And other people told her also, she didn't work.
No.
But I believe that it's good way to say what you feel. Oh. I just think maybe the attitude or the way that maybe you say it wasn't the right way, that bring the wrong way, that bring the result that you didn't expect. I think that if you come from a really balanced and quiet place with compassion, and say what you think, you know, affects you, and maybe what other people say, or what. But maybe it's not a fact. Maybe it's not a fact. I think it's maybe something I believe.
It's worth giving and I can't give you answers, a good lady's not here, but it's worth giving some reflection to. Something which feels original, unexpected, and honest, but original. Original. And if you dig deep enough, you'll come up with something original, which you won't forget. Very original, I mean. Very original. Never been done before on this earth. Very, very original. Yes, anyone, please. A few more minutes. Yes, please, yes.
I was thinking about what you said about commitment. Please.
Yes.
There is a power in making a commitment.
Yes.
I mean, actually taking a commitment like a marriage vow.
Yes.
So what about the power of making the commitment? Like you said about this woman, about people that are sitting for years in the office.
Yes.
Commitment has a life of its own. Mm. Actually, some people need making a commitment in order to perform a spiritual life at all. Mm. And if they take a commitment, maybe they don't like it every morning before they do.
No.
Mm-hmm. But afterwards, they feel good.
Mm. So, any commitments in your life?
Sorry?
Any commitments at present in your life? Yeah. No. So, what sustains the commitment is the love, isn't it? As I mentioned.
In this specific commitment, what has to sustain it is a very deep love.
Yes.
But I'm I'm talking about a commitment to, let's say, a spiritual path, which also should be sustained by love. I'm talking about this power in actually making a commitment. It's like, you know, the people that they get married, some people say that the actual taking the vow in front of God or whatever it is.
Other people.
Has a power.
Yes.
Apart from the love that is also sustaining.
If I may just repeat myself a little bit. Commitment, like everything else in life, everything cannot exist by itself. Commitment requires other aspects of our inner life, and quite often others as well, but other to keep the commitment alive, to keep it from falling apart. And that's why I said earlier on, we rather have to know ourselves with regard to commitment. The commitment itself doesn't have power unless other factors contribute to it. So that can be a commitment of marriage, beautiful vows, a beautiful commitment. But it only has meaning, not by itself, it has meaning by what we contribute to it, the way that we nourish it, the way that we support it. Because unless we do that, it's only words. It's only words, I make a commitment. And the power of yesterday, which may have been said very, very strongly, I make a commitment till death do us part, has no power to sustain itself unless there are other factors within us which are contributing to it. Love is a primary one. Interest, interconnectedness, respect. All of that keeps the commitment. And sometimes people make the commitment, they intend it, they say it very strongly, it's made publicly, it's made to God, whatever that is, and then boom, fades out. Person forgot. Commitment has, in Buddhist language, no existence unto itself. It has no self-existence. It arises because of other factors. So the power of commitment is a power only if other factors are present. Love, interest, support, interconnectedness, etc. Reminders. 50% of marriages in Britain end in divorce. The commitment from one or the other went. In European cities, more than 50% of the population live alone. Some voluntarily and very happily, and some involuntarily and unhappily, etc. And some in very committed relationships, and they feel the best chance for their relationship to survive is by not living together. And there's a growing number of people like that. Many. The relationship sustains itself, well, through not living together. And some have never used, I have plenty of friends who have never used the word commitment. It's never fallen out of their mouth. And others will say, gosh, they're such a committed relationship. And the reason they're in a committed relationship because they haven't made a commitment. They just love each other. It's enough. So I don't think commitment is critically important. You know, some people get a little upset when I say this, but I don't think it's critically important. I think love is critically important. And some friends of mine, they were not married for years, they didn't get married. And then one or other decided they should express their commitment and got married. Before they were married, they were doing wonderfully well. Years. 5, 10, 15 years. Then they decided to get married to show commitment. It was the biggest mistake they ever made. Right after, one of them, I've got one example in mind, one of them got married and felt trapped. And then the problem started. And within a few months, it was all over. The marriage felt for the person to feel trapped. So sometimes the love is there, some take the love with the commitment, with the vow, with the marriage, and it just works harmoniously and beautifully there. I think it's the love which is the sustaining power more than the past. Personally, I have to say all this, I'm not speaking from experience with marriage. I'm not having ever been married. I pay great respect to all of those who have had the courage to do it, but not my cup of tea. Not my cup of tea. When my daughter was born, I said to Granwin, daughter's mother, 2 or 3 weeks after they get more, do you think we should get married? I said it so half-heartedly, with such a long face, it never got discussed again. And others, it's a beautiful statement. It's a statement of love. It's confirmed through a ceremony. And in Stockholm last year, one of the teachers, Leela, she got married, that one of the Dharma teachers, to Christian from Luxembourg. And she kindly asked me if at the wedding I would say a few words, as she said, to give a blessing for the wedding. So, in dear old progressive Sweden, she invited the what's it called? I suppose. What do you call people who get married? The council, registrar. So it was held in the back garden of a small hotel in the summer. And there were probably 40 or 50 guests down the fence. And then the registrar came, and they stood together, and we played some music. I said a few words. We had a poem that I wrote for the marriage, etc. there. And they got married. I understand it's a bit more difficult listening to Nathan getting married here. So and they got married, and it's a lovely gesture. And it tells other people at the same time, we are together, we are a couple, we love each other, and it's a reminder of respect for the dedication. I think that's beautiful. Beautiful. Yes.
Making a commitment is only words by itself. It's only words.
Yeah.
But it did break a relationship. You know, your friends that got divorced because
See,
some sort of magical power.
Oh, wait, magical power. If it was magical power, I'd want to be married. So I'd take the risk for a bit of magical power. Anybody want to marry me in here? I'll take anyone for a bit of. Sorry. Oh, isn't it? Oh. Oh, well, I didn't know that. Black magic. All right. So, for some, this is, once again, come back to the knowing of ourselves here. Particularly in the culture of vibrancy and huge world of change we're living, we're living in a constant social upheaval. Nothing is fixed like it used to be. Nothing. Religion, social, society, values, priorities. Look at the diversity of what we're exposed to. There's never been a culture like the one that we're all living. Look at the influences that are coming in. Look at all the interests in spirituality, in diet, in lifestyle, in organic food, in philosophy, in ways of being in this world, in values, in the corporate world, in political world, in the alternative world. We're a culture who've had a phenomenal amount of exposure at a global level. It's unheard of what we're at yet, the period of social change and social upheaval that we're all living through. And it's a world of massive change from one day to the next. And as we said this afternoon, the chaos theory comes out of us, the uncertainty principles come out of all this, because that's what we're living in, all of this. And I think all of that kind of participation in it means that we do feel the uncertainties, we feel them a bit more. We feel the changes a bit more, we feel the vulnerabilities a little bit more. The outcome of that, for some people, is some hesitation, which I understand, and I'm sure you appreciate, about commitment, because there's too much uncertainty. And trying to force the mind to be in commitment, for some, gives the feeling of restriction, of limitation. And it doesn't have to have any of that, of course it doesn't. It can be a beautiful expression. So in the specific example that I had in mind, they were together for years, they'd known them for years. They decided to get married. And she, after a few months, after the marriage, instead of it being a confirmation of the love and the continuity of it, began to feel imprisoned. Began to feel restricted and limited. And then began to rebel. And it became a struggle. And the struggle ended that they ended the marriage. Became friends, you know, afterwards, etc. But it was over. And her thought and her feeling was about it was that introducing the word commitment and getting formally married, that she didn't realize it was not what she could do. She wasn't ready for it. She had to go through that to realize that. And I do think for some people, we've got to listen to each other and be respectful for where we are. And it's not quite fair, maybe not wise nor skillful, that commitment is important to us, therefore somebody who we are close to, we start putting on him or her, put pressure. But I think it tends to lead to more problems. And I think the love is better than references to the future. I think it's more likely to sustain itself, as a general view. Anyone else finally today? While I've been sitting here, I've been wondering, since here, what are those two things on the wall? Has anybody got any penetrative insight into it? I just Is it, does it say anything in Hebrew up there?
Israel?
It's the map of Israel. Is that a baseball bat at the top? Pardon? It's a map of Israel and Israel. I can see that. I can't get the rest of it.
Like little David, if you just go right, the whole world, the world politics, the Arab world on the other side. The little Goliath, the little David, this
one. Is that what it is? Yeah, throwing the stone, the sling. And what about the right hand one? Is that a cigar over there or something? No, what is it?
The West Bank.
The West Bank. Looks like a.
It's a pilot's view of the West Bank.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's a little. All right, let's have a couple of quiet minutes together, shall we?